At first glance, it was like any other New York morning. But it was to be a morning remembered for years to come. At 8:30 a.m., the usual commuters were traveling to work by subway or on foot. Thousands took the elevators up the World Trade Center towers. 2,000 of them would never come down alive. A catastrophic collision was about to take place. Wars were to be waged. Civilian lives were to be lost. But this was a game that had started years ago. It had taken decades for the main players to become who they were now, who the tragedy needed them to be. But now, the long, painful prelude was over. It was a warm, sunny day. The sky almost clear. A perfect stage for the grand crescendo. This was by no means a conspiracy. It was a long, sad tragedy coming to a late, fearsome finale. The Empire was to pay a price for all the fears. At 0 hour, all hell broke loose.
That said, we've got to hit back. We've got to deal with these nasty people who've done such an awful thing. Where are they? And the problem with Al-Qaeda was that it was very hard to find them. And so it's been Afghanistan and Iraq and the people of Afghanistan and Iraq who've paid the price.
And that, for example, on 9/11 itself, just I think about 5 hours after the attacks, we know that Donald Rumsfeld told some of his aides that he wanted the best information as quickly as possible to see whether this could be linked to Saddam Hussein, whether they could go beyond Osama bin Laden, and the actual words that he used were "go massive, sweep it all up."
For the neocons, this was all they needed to convince America of the need to aggressively pursue and maintain a unilateral hegemony over the world.
President Bush called me in my prime minister's office in Oslo a week before the US and UK-led invasion of Iraq. And of course he wanted me as Norwegian prime minister to join him in the war. But I said, "Mr. President, I'm sorry, I cannot." And out of two reasons. First of all, you don't have a mandate from the UN Security Council to do this. And secondly, from my Christian ethical values.
For the Hawks, it was the old days all over again.
Apparently it was on 9/11 itself that Dick Cheney actually said specifically that, look, find a link to Saddam Hussein. Just do it. You know, find anything. You know, and they've been doing that ever since.
People are so used to constructing foreign policy in oppositional terms, vis-a-vis an enemy, a rogue state, terrorism.
Because a lot of people think we're fighting this war, and this is a war on terror. We're going into Iraq, into Afghanistan. We may be misguided, we may be doing it wrong, but we are doing it because we're trying to fight the terrorist threat.
The same system that for years had learned to function based on evil enemies. The same system that for a decade had not found a substitute for the old enemy, had found what it had yearned for. The gears got working again.
So right away there was this effort to take advantage of this horrible tragedy on the part of some in the White House. This was some saw this as an opportunity to strike back and to basically reorder the Middle East And of course, topping the list at that time was Iraq.
We know that when the Bush cabinet was deliberating at Camp David in the days after 9/11, that both Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz did bring up the idea of attacking Iraq. Rumsfeld famously said that there were better targets for the Air Force in Iraq than there were in Afghanistan.
The Bush think tank, you know, we had Dick Cheney, Richard Armitage, John Bolton, all of the key players in the current administration were part of this think tank. They had written already about going into Iraq several years ago.
Someone is waiting for a so-called smoking gun. It's certain that we will have waited too long.
We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud.
We cannot wait for the final proof. The smoking gun that could come in the form of...
Well, the 1% doctrine, this was a phrase coined by Dick Cheney, actually. And the idea behind it was that Cheney argued...
And this supposedly comes from Dick Cheney, said, even if there's a 1% chance that Saddam is developing nuclear weapons and this might be turned over to Al-Qaeda, we have to assume that this is happening and we're not going to sit back and we're going to be proactive and we're going to go and take them out.
But Afghanistan had to be dealt with. Afghanistan was attacked.
And it began with the cruise missiles landing about half a mile away from my house. And a cruise missile, when it lands, it shakes the whole earth. It's like an earthquake. And when you have your wife and your children and other people's children coming because they're afraid, I took them down into my cellar, covered the windows and everything with mattresses and hid and prayed that the bombs don't land on our house.
The Eurocentric double standards that are applied. If a white country had been harboring Osama bin Laden, would they go around just mass bombing the countryside and the towns? Of course they would. But it's okay to do that in Afghanistan.
But Afghanistan was not what the neocons were after. The problem was that what they were after had nothing to do with 9/11.
Next stop on this particular war on terror tour, of course, came to be Iraq. And again, they helped him stay in power. And of course, they were the ones who had given him so many chemical weapons that they believed he still had in the 1990s. And one suspects that they were so adamant that he had got them only because they knew they'd given him in the first place.
Bush made the decision that Afghanistan would be taken care of first. But even while that campaign was still going on, the U.S. began to shift resources towards preparing for a war with Iraq. In fact, this is one of the criticisms of the United States, of the Bush administration, is that just when it had bin Laden on the ropes and had a chance to kill him, to capture him, to basically finish Al-Qaeda, they began to pull resources and began to shift the focus to Iraq, and they've never ever regained that focus on bin Laden.
If the war on terror was a war on terror, there wouldn't be a war in Iraq, because Iraq really had little to do with terror.
However, as time passed, things changed.
From the first day of the Bush administration, Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney both wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein in Iraq. That's pretty clear. Now why? To bring freedom to Iraq? Well, no.
Although Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, 9/11 had a lot to do with Iraq. Because most Americans, I would suspect, see the conquest of Iraq as a defensive reaction to 9/11. It's not, of course, but that's the way they see it. And that's the way it's been made politically acceptable.
What they had done before with Plan B and Rumsfeld's committee was now being done with the Office of Special Plans.
By then, its mission was more defined. It had to look for information that might connect Saddam Hussein to the 9/11 attacks and would demonstrate that he had weapons of mass destruction. So critics of that have said that it resulted in what we call cherry-picking of information, which is information where you look for information that supports your theory. And another thing, actually, that happened that was quite significant, there was what we call stovepiping of intelligence, and this was where raw intelligence, instead of being analysed by the professionals at the CIA, was actually just passed directly to policymakers like Cheney and Rumsfeld for them to analyse it themselves.
In the meantime, Cheney grabbed his chance to take back what he believed they'd lost when Nixon resigned, an unprecedented level of executive power.
Cheney's interest in the expansion of presidential power really was something that came about post 9/11. I think because Cheney viewed it as an emergency situation, one in which the president had to be sure that he had as much freedom of action as possible.
In the overtly patriotic atmosphere of post 9/11, Cheney got what he wanted and used it on what he shouldn't have.
Cheney was quite important when it comes to the question of interrogating detainees. They designated them as enemy combatants. So this was this new phrase which they claimed would allow them to abandon the Geneva Conventions. And I think you had really a slippery slope to serious mistreatment and eventually torture.
Every day you had that type of interrogation, being punched, being kicked, being beaten, watching other people being beaten, humiliated, being stripped naked, having no communication at all with the world, having for 2 years no hot meal, no hot drink, no vegetables, no fruit. Terrible things, you know. I mean, they do the hang up people with their hands behind their back, hang them up off the ceiling, beat them on the soles of the feet, electrocution to the genitalia, electrocution to different parts of the body, solitary confinement in a box. I mean, in a box like a coffin for days, where you just got holes inside the coffin so you can breathe only. I mean, some very terrible, brutal things.
The political pressure continued to grow.
The only single shred of evidence they ever found over this was the fact that Saddam Hussein had given somewhere between $10,000 and $25,000 to particular families in Palestine that had engaged in suicide bombing.
After 9/11, news came up about this so-called Prague meeting, which was supposedly a meeting between Mohammed Atta, one of the 9/11 hijackers, and an Iraqi intelligence agent in Prague. And the meeting was initially reported by the Czech intelligence service.
In the end, I believe the Czech intelligence said, well, actually, we don't have conclusive evidence of this. And the 9/11 commission said that there's no evidence Mohammed Atta ever was in Prague meeting an Iraqi intelligence agent. In fact, the suggestion was that he actually was in the U.S. at the time where he was supposed to have been in Prague. So there was no evidence at all.
Despite the continued pressure from Cheney and the neocons, there was still no hard evidence of a link between Saddam and Al-Qaeda or weapons of mass destruction. The gang had to convince the American people that non-existent evidence actually existed. For the people, the method they employed was simple.
And I think the plan basically was to... It sounds quite crude and quite vulgar, but if you mention Iraq and Al-Qaeda in the same breath enough times, people will start to associate those two things. And if you look at opinion polls, the majority of Americans thought that there was some relationship between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. There was never any substantive evidence of that. What there was a whole lot of assertions from the president, from the vice president, from members of the cabinet, that the two were in some way connected and that Saddam Hussein had these large stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. This was based on very little evidence, but I think they really worked off the premise of if you say something enough times, people will start to believe it.
Massive and sudden horror.
Massive death and destruction.
Death on a massive scale.
The danger to our country is grave. The danger to our country is growing. The Iraqi regime possesses biological and chemical weapons. It has sponsored and sheltered terrorists.
Paying suicide
chemical
bombers.
Weapons are equally chosen.
Biological weapons, including anthrax and botulism toxins.
Biological and chemical agent to kill millions of people.
Chemical weapons, including VX and sarin.
But what worked on the people could not fool the politicians. They needed something more. And for this purpose, Cheney had put aside Colin Powell.
I think Bush chose Powell to go to the United Nations because he thought that it would play well with the European countries. Powell was seen as less of a hawk than people like Rumsfeld.
If he said the world needed to invade Iraq, they would take it better than from Bush.
In February 2003, Tenet made this famous comment that the evidence about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction was a slam dunk case. Powell was obviously going to make his presentation to the UN about the intelligence that the US had, and he was checking with Tenet whether it was solid information, and Tenet said, yes, it's a slam dunk case.
Powell still had doubts. If he was to go down, he would take Tenet down with him.
When he was giving his presentation, Powell wanted Tenet to be within view, so sitting just behind him, and it would be a way of associating the CIA and the concept of intelligence with the speech that Powell was giving.
My second purpose today is to provide you with additional information, to share with you what the United States knows about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, as well as Iraq's involvement in terrorism, which is also the subject of Resolution 1441 and other earlier resolutions.
Powell's presentation at the UN, he showed a number of satellite photographs which were really inconclusive. He alleged that the buildings shown in the photographs were chemical weapons factories and biological weapons factories.
The purpose of the Iraq War in 2003 was to demonstrate that America was all-powerful. That's the point of it. It wasn't just for the oil. It wasn't just for weapons of mass destruction. It definitely wasn't for that.
One particularly infamous comment that Powell made in his presentation to the UN was that Iraq had sought uranium, which is an ingredient for a nuclear weapon, from the West African country of Niger. This claim had actually already been discredited by the CIA, but it was put into Powell's speech anyway.
Powell himself has described it as a, quote, a blot on his career, unquote, because there was no substance to his presentation. And the CIA knew this.
The Bush administration, when it waged war, or as it has waged war, once you got beyond the initial pretext that it was responding to 9/11,
war that would cost 1 million civilian lives on the Iraqi side and 4,000 troops on the American side. A war that would cost $3 trillion in a time of financial crisis. After the initial victory celebrations were over, the secrets began to go public one by one. Torture, abduction, wiretapping, secrets of secrets that were not there, meetings that did not take place, yellow cakes that did not exist, evidence that had never been found.
If you look at opinion polls, the majority of people favored in the United States favored the invasion of Iraq, and they favored it, I think majority favored, and then once it started, then the numbers went even higher, and now the numbers have gone down where a majority said that they wish they had never invaded Iraq, and an even larger number want U.S. troops pulled out. So the American people didn't have, I would say didn't have a lot of enthusiasm for the invasion, but it was so often portrayed as getting back for 9/11, this sense of revenge, and that this is a way of striking back for 9/11. Even you saw some rhetoric from soldiers going off saying, well, this is our chance to get back for 9/11.
2 years and 1 million civilian casualties later, the secret would become common knowledge. The fact that the whole thing was a lie.
The Americans, we've seen it in recent, we've seen it in Iraq, for example, in Fallujah. There's a nasty tendency to go in and use your firepower. And this, of course, helps create a lot of enemies because you are seen by the locals as the enemy. They don't see you on their side. And I think that there are elements in American military culture that are not very helpful in insurgency situations.
The golden years of the Bush administration were over. Heads had to roll. Rumsfeld got the axe.
He was an easy scapegoat, really. And I think his position became untenable when so many former generals began to speak out against him and say that he was the worst Secretary of Defense ever. Bush was doing badly in the polls and also in, if I recall correctly, in the midterm elections. And I think there came a point when things were going so badly in Iraq that somebody had to be the fall guy, and I think it was Rumsfeld, really. He was a scapegoat. Cheney made very little comment about it publicly. I think it would be safe to say, since the two share a common world outlook and they go back such a long way, I think it would be safe to say that he would have been sad to see Rumsfeld go.
Tenet too was sacrificed. The CIA lost its power like never before.
The CIA is always set up to be the political scapegoat, and I think that's what happened in this case. On the one hand, you could say Tenet was treated very badly because he was very much blamed as the head of the CIA for the fact that the agency apparently made a mistake and got the intelligence wrong. On the other hand, perhaps he got what he deserved because he clearly made a decision to go along with what the Bush administration wanted. As a result of the so-called intelligence failure and George Tenet's departure, there was a major reorganization of the US intelligence community in which the CIA lost a lot of power and prestige.
The days of the neocons had also come to an end. Despite all their efforts, they had only accelerated the coming of the end of the unipolar moment.
But the Bush administration gambled. They said, we're going to do it a different way. We're going to be dominant not just by extending economic influence, we're going to be dominant by controlling resources. We are going to control oil, and we are going to control other commodities, and we are going to set the terms of international trade, and we are going to have our military throughout the globe. That means our power is not just simply on a cooperative basis, it's on more of what you could say is a unilateral basis. Some have called it unipolar. They gambled, and Iraq was the demonstration case for that gamble.
When Charles Krauthammer first wrote his Unipolar Moment article, he said that he thought that this that the unipolar moment could actually, if America had the willpower, it could last for a generation. In 2006, he gave a speech in which he said the unipolar moment is now in decline. So the original architect of the unipolar moment now believes that the US is very, very slowly in decline, that it's past the apogee of unipolarity. Well, the neocons don't see this as a problem with their ideas. They think that the Bush administration went about things the wrong way. For example, they argue that instead of setting up an interim administration led by Paul Bremer, the US should have set up the Iraqi National Congress as the government of Iraq.
And all of the studies that have been done show clear that they're looking at upwards of a million casualties in Iraq as a result of our war. Now, just take the proportions, 3,000 in the United States, and perhaps more than a million killed post 9/11 as a response.
I think there's a problem there in that this idea of unipolarity, it doesn't allow for US allies to take an autonomous stance on anything. It requires that they support the US always. And if you had that, then yes, the US might have greater legitimacy, but I think it's unlikely that old Europe is going to support policies that are designed to perpetuate the unipolar moment.
When saying United States of America, I'm also thinking of the only superpower in the world of today. And I'm thinking of a current administration believing too much in unilateral actions instead of multilateralism. And of course, for a superpower, it can be attractive to act unilateral because you are so strong. But in the long term, all countries will lose to do so. And to have effective multilateralism, you need some common rules, common values, which could be the platform to act in common. And for me, this is, first of all, the human rights.
Initially had, after 9/11, a lot of sympathy and support, and then when it became clear that the Bush administration was determined to invade Iraq, even though Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, that support just dissipated.
But for all that they did, the neocons were never a true divergence from traditional US foreign policy. For much of the latter part of the 20th century, US foreign policy was premised on the existence of an evil enemy to which only the world's police should respond. There is a moment stuck in time with all of the players, with all of us. An ever-resonating moment on a sunny New York morning when innocent civilians are boarding the elevator up the Twin Towers, never to return. An ever-resonating moment on an eternal September morning when we pass each other on the streets with our heads down as if we know we are all guilty. Maybe a phone call we never made, a question we never asked our government, a war crime we let pass, maybe there was a politician we could have warned. There is an eternal September morning, each and every day, when a man gets on the plane.